Welcome to Souls on Fire with your host, Joe Trainer. Joe is a husband and father of three, and for 29 years was an award-winning and very successful college football coach. Today, he is the director of athletics for Pope John Paul II High School. He is a leader, a man of character, and filled with the joy of the Lord. Joe was running for God's heart and became a soul on fire. Listen in every Monday as Joe interviews other sports figures and businessmen and women who bring their faith into the marketplace. And now, here's Joe Trainer.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Souls on Fire on this beautiful Monday afternoon, celebrating the big win yesterday, Victoria, huh?
Yeah,
go
Birds.
Go Birds. I love it. You come in, you're all decked out in your Eagles outfit, and we were talking before about the superstition that I think every sports fan has their superstitions, but I think in Philly we kind of we take that to the nth degree. So she was just saying, having the foresight to say, hey, where she's going to be at game time and what seat she's in and all the idiosyncrasies that that we follow here as we cheer our Birds on to what will be an unbelievable experience if we get to live through another Super Bowl championship. So before I introduce our special guest here, let's begin in prayer as we begin every show. In the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, amen. Heavenly Father, as Victoria and I spend the next hour in faith and fellowship, we ask that our thoughts be your thoughts, that our words be your words, and when we leave here tonight, that our deeds be your deeds. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. This person that I have with me is absolutely one of my favorite people in the world. I know her parents might be listening, but I'm going to throw it out there. She is my favorite Hudak. I've told her that in secret. I'm kidding, Laura Steve. I've always felt a connection with Victoria. She's just somebody that kind of is on a different journey than most, and as always, even as a young professional, has been big picture. She gets it. She can walk with a lot of different types of people and still be authentic, and I've always admired that about her, because a lot of times I think young professionals, you know, like I was till I was probably early 30s, you know, we suffer from the disease of me, and it's all about me and what I can accumulate. But just out of college, she's always been other-centered. She's always been a big-picture person, and I've always admired her about that. So Victoria Rose Hudak, Philadelphia born and bred, cradle Catholic, oldest of four children, to dear friends Steve and Laura Hudak, cradle Catholic, went to Catholic elementary school, graduated from Gwinnett Mercy Academy in 2012 as a very accomplished athlete, went on to get her nursing degree from Temple University in 2017. As recently as last December, she graduated with a master's in science in advanced clinical management leadership from Columbia University. So she's an egghead at heart. She's a closet egghead, I'll say that. Incredibly smart. But you don't. She doesn't wear that on her sleeve because she's so authentic. Currently, she works in New York City at New York Presbyterian, and she as an oncology nurse on the hematology and oncology unit. So we're thrilled to have her here, and she's going to give us great insight over the next hour. So, Victoria, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited you're here. So talk about, you know, obviously the burden of being the oldest, right? You know, and I always say, your father and I talk ad nauseum about, you know, the ways we try and screw up our kids as best we can. But no, in seriousness, the oldest of four. Talk about your upbringing and your family and high school, and then kind of we'll get into like college and thereafter from there.
Yeah. So I I have oldest child syndrome for sure. I love being in charge. And so I have two brothers and then a much younger sister. Grew up like suburban Philadelphia, Catholic school. I did go to public school for a little while. And yeah, just playing sports, hanging out outside, always with my brothers. Yeah.
Awesome. Now, you know, you go to Temple. Did you go in as a nursing major?
No, I changed my mind.
Okay. We'll talk about that process.
So I kind of always in the back of my head wanted to be a nurse or wanted to be in the medical field, but I don't know that first of all, I didn't understand how much work goes into it. I thought sure. I was like, yeah, I'll go, I'll figure it out, I'll change my major. And that's not how it works at all. So I had to work really hard my first semester of college to even be accepted into the nursing program. And I was lucky in high school. I mean, my parents will tell you, I didn't really try hard.
Sure.
I got, you know, A's and B's with a lot more having fun than studying.
Sure.
So college was the first time I was like, oh, wow. Like, if I want this, I really have to make sacrifices and work for it. So I ended up being at Temple for 5 years. And I was devastated when I found out I had to do a fifth year. Like, I did, you know, there's a stigma, like, 5 years in college. I just wanted to, like, be on the same path as my friends.
Sure.
And it turned out my fifth year, I moved home with my parents. And two of my best friends from Gwinnett, actually, you know, they had graduated, but they weren't ready to move out. So they were at home, too. And it was, like, the best year. We still talk about it.
That's
like,
awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I That's dreaded cool. it forever. And it was so much fun.
Awesome. Now, when you decided to get into nursing, I mean, I've always viewed, like, a lot of those medical professional jobs. That's, you know, I view that more as a vocation than it is, you know, a job, you know, even more. And I think there's jobs, then there's careers, then there's vocations. Like, I think, and knowing you and what you bring to the table with that, I mean, I could definitely see you having incredible success in this vocation. What was it about nursing that appealed to you, you know, at the end of the day where you said, listen, this is the path I'm going to go?
I think it's the best of a lot of worlds. Like, you get to make a difference. You're with people on the best days and the worst days of their lives. And like, making a difference and still having it be a career was always appealing to me. But it's also, like, highly respected. Like,
no doubt.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, your brain's always working. Like, you're always critically thinking, and I learn something new every day. So it's never, I'm never bored in that job.
Sure. Now, obviously, under the umbrella of nursing, right, there's 1,000 different ways you could go. You know, you could be, you could be, you know, you could go the office coordinator path of, you know, kind of, I'm not minimizing that because they do great work too, but more of like the corporate, you know, 9-to-5-ish, you know, assist in that process with checkups and well visits and stuff like that, you know, and then here you are, you know, literally and figuratively on the margins, right? Like, you know, dealing with, you know, you choose to go into oncology nursing. So is that a calling within a calling, or is that kind of just like, once you said, hey, I want to get into nursing, this is going to be my vocation. Like, how did you then decide, like, okay, this within the vocation is going to be my specialty?
I think it is with nursing, because nurses will always say, like, oh, I could never do what you do. Like, I love what I do, and people do consider it to be one of the harder specialties. Mostly, I think, because of the emotional part. But, I mean, I would never want to be an L&D nurse. Like, that to me seems really hard and really emotional. But most nurses, I feel like, so when I initially wanted to be a nurse, I wanted to work in the emergency room. Did one rotation there and was like, absolutely not. Like, not for me. It's crazy. It's hectic. It's just not what I wanted. So I actually, Temple has a cancer center. The Fox Chase Cancer Center is
one of the best in the world.
Yeah. One of the first cancer centers ever in the United States. And I got put at a clinical there and I really liked it. And then my junior year of college, University of Pennsylvania Hospital runs a nurse residency program for rising seniors. And I applied and I got it. And I just happened to be put on a hematology oncology floor, which is leukemia, lymphoma, bone marrow transplant, like blood cancers. And I loved it. So then going into my senior year, when they ask you, you know, your like your final year, what they put you in, what you want to do.
Sure.
Literally everyone was like begging for labor and delivery, or NICU, like baby stuff.
Sure.
And the emergency room. And I was like, I want the cancer stuff. So I got lucky because not many people wanted to do it. So, I mean, I've been working in cancer officially as a nurse for 5.5 years, but really it's been more like 8.
Sure. When you throw in your undergraduate experience and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. Now, obviously, knowing that you're always keeping your parents on edge with just to throw them for a loop. So you have all these, you know, great hospitals in Philly, you know, and you could certainly say, oh, you know what, we're going to, you know, we're going to be an earshot from home. Mm-hmm. And you do what you do and you say, you know what, I'm going to go up the road a little bit and I'm going to settle in up in New York City. What was the thought process behind that?
I was like dying to get out of Philly. So I grew up suburban Philadelphia, but my parents took us to the city all the time.
Absolutely.
I went to Temple, like super immersed in the city, did my 5th year. And I was just like, I want to do something new. My parents always took us up to New York for Christmas. And I loved it. And I think it just got in my head, like, I want to go there. So I, thankfully, one of my best friends had a friend from college who was working on the floor I wanted to work at the hospital to work at. Yeah. And then one of the doctors from my internship, who's like he's an assistant professor. He might be only a professor now at Penn.
Okay.
He was like, where do you want to work? And I was like, I want to go to New York. He's like, oh, I know one in college that's up there. Perfect. Like, I just kind of got lucky with all these people in my life.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I was like, peace out. I mean, I signed a lease in New York City before I had a job, which is insane.
That's hilarious. That's awesome. Yeah. And you're here for the Birds game yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, you're a short train ride or car ride from family. And I know mom and dad get up there a bit too.
Mm-hmm.
So just going back to high school for a second, you go to Gwinnett Mercy, mm-hmm. and you're a strong leader. You walk into a room and you have this, you know, great presence. So you go to an all girls high school, okay? Mm-hmm. So talk about that. What was that like? You know, not academically, but what was that like in terms of like, you know, developing, you know, your character and some of those things. Empowering you, learning what, you know, strong female leadership mm-hmm. looks like. Talk about that, like, and the single sex high school experience was for you.
So I loved it. My best friends to this day are all from Gwinnett. I think I appreciate it more now. Like, I think Gwinnett does a great job at, like, empowering females. It's all about, like, female leadership. And never in my mind did I think I couldn't be a leader because I was a girl.
Sure.
And, like, I didn't even realize that was a thing until I left Gwinnett. Because there, it's like,
sure.
No, absolutely, this is what you're going to do.
That's awesome.
So when people talk about, like, high school like that, I didn't have that experience of, like, belittlement maybe.
Sure.
Or just, like, I'm not, like, strong enough or smart enough or any of those things. Like, Gwinnett, I think it's so small and it is only girls that they make they can focus on you. Like, they can focus on your strengths. They can put you in the classes you need to be in.
Confidence. All of it.
Yeah. They, like, infuse confidence into people. And, I mean, it's a ton of different people, but everyone always got along really well. Like, the typical high school experience of, like, who's popular, who's not, who's cliques, like, who's dating who's going to this, who's going to that. I mean, it definitely existed. Like, we loved going to school.
That's awesome.
We had so much fun. You could, like, totally be yourself.
What a novel concept that is for high school kids.
Yeah, like we always talk about it. Like, we had this back lunch table that we always sat at, and I was like, I would go, like, we would go back for a week.
That's
like, if
hilarious.
We could just do 1 week again. And I think it allowed the teachers too to be like more our peers. Like, they for sure were like authority figures.
Sure.
But they were like, not, I won't want to say they were friends, but it was a very like relaxing environment to be in.
That's cool. I think too, like, just not having the drama of the opposite sex and then maybe like kind of trying to be someone you're not and all the things as you're forming your own identity, right?
Right.
You're navigating from, you know, 14 to 18, you know, and then all the things that you're trying to work through, peer groups and who am I and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And to just not have the day to day drama of expectations and distractions.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And this is pre like cell phones in school.
Yeah.
Like, you literally couldn't talk to the boys. Like, my sister, I think they're like texting them.
Right. I was thinking the other day, like, could you imagine telling any of these private high schools, telling kids they, you know, you weren't allowed to bring phones into school. Kids would leave in droves.
We used to get them taken away.
Yeah.
Like, I specifically, we had a Spanish teacher, and you know, my friends, we all have differing levels of I don't want to say how smart, intelligence levels.
Sure.
And we all were not good at Spanish. So we were all in the same Spanish class. And the teacher, it would get rowdy and stuff. Like, I can remember her taking our phones and they were stacked on her desk. And, like, you were in trouble.
Sure.
Like, she could send you the principal if you want.
Sure.
Now, if Mia doesn't bring her computer to school, she's in trouble.
Yeah, no doubt. And it's not, what is it, 10 years? It's not like
no,
it's
it feels like yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. So I do want to go back to your early time in New York because, mm-hmm. you know, we have COVID, right? COVID
yeah.
hits. And then it's like, you know, and then I think, what was it, 2019, was it? Or
it was, yeah, I mean, we started hearing about March. It like January,
okay. You
December.
Started before the rest of us. So, yeah, you started here in December, January.
Hearing,
in
yeah.
the medical field.
Mm-hmm.
Lay people like us mm-hmm. that are just out there. You know, I think it was probably March before, like, you know, oh, my gosh.
It was, like March 15th, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and then not really knowing what to expect. And then us seeing, you know, oh, my God, it's almost like we're going to have it. You know, it's like that snow day mentality. Oh, we're going to have off for like a week or so. It's going to be really cute. And we're going
to
have fun.
You don't have to go to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're going to just watch movies for a little bit and be around your pajamas for 2 weeks. And there you are really in the epicenter of, you know, the crisis hits everybody. But there you are
mm-hmm.
in the epicenter. You're already dealing with compromised systems of immunity. And, you know, the reality is, however we feel like on the political spectrum, you know, it was real, you know, and you professionally were dealing with the most vulnerable. And really, I'm just listening to the stories at the beach, like, and like that, I could listen to the hundreds of stories, right? It mm-hmm. was just, and then, you know, we're putting these patients and not having room and people dying. And then almost like certainly never having experienced combat or never been involved in war. As I would listen to your stories and recall from other medical professionals, it was really that combat mentality where it was the volume of death and mortality that was around you was just so hard for the rest of us to comprehend because mm-hmm. we were just worried about getting, you know, a cough and losing taste and being on the shelf for 10 days and it spreading through the family. But you were there living like, and really kind of, you moved up to New York City when?
I moved in June of 2017. So okay. I was
just over 2 years there, right?
Yeah. Which is crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. But still like still early in your career.
Yeah.
You know, there
sure.
you are kind of cutting your teeth in the new city, new profession. And then, you know, we're hit with this. So walk us through like those first probably 6 months where you probably went from, okay, this is something. And then it's like, oh my God, this is like a, you know, a monster in the room. Walk us through that for a little bit.
So we were kind of like the rest of everybody else. I would say December, we started to hear about it. January, it was like the bat soup thing. We all thought it was funny.
Sure.
Like no one's really thinking it's going to be anything. And then I guess I think February, it started to get a little bit. Once management started to be like, if this happens, here's our contingency plan, which that plan changed about a million times.
Sure.
But I remember, so it was that March. It was, I think it was like the 14th or 15th. It was that Friday, yeah. I believe, that like it started to become a thing because – so none of my good friends are nurses. I mean, I have very good friends who are nurses, but my home, high school,
yeah.
like no one's medical. I have one friend who's a PT, but and they started texting me. Like they were like, what's going on? They're sending us home from work. Two of my best friends who lived in the city were like rushing to Amtrak trains. I was like, what's going on? Like, I'm not even seeing anything.
Sure.
So it's important to know that I work at Weill Cornell Medical Center, which is a world-renowned medical center. It's connected to Cornell University's medical school.
Okay.
And it's in a very wealthy, privileged area of New York. So we were always about 2 weeks behind the harder hit areas. I just remember going to work one day and things were head start. We had a lot of COVID patients. No one really knew what to do. There was a different rule every day about what could be done. People are calling me like, what's going on? I'm like, I don't know what's going on.
Sure.
Like, but I remember I was walking to the elevator and there was a patient in a bed that he was saran wrapped. like he was underneath Saran wrap on a bed because he had to go to like an MRI or something and they had to bring him from his room, but they didn't want to like, we didn't know how contagious it was at this time. And I remember I was with one of my friends and we both just looked at each other and we're like, okay, this is like whatever's being said on the news is like, it's here.
Sure.
So what happened was, so I do, my patients are extremely immunocompromised. Like we're talking like literally white blood cells. So what we did was we tried to put them all in their private rooms. Anyone who could get their chemo outpatient, we didn't want them to come in the hospital. So we actually had less of our patients. So they took our nurses to the COVID unit, which we have a psych unit on our 11th floor. And they sent all those psych patients upstate, or I don't even know, that honestly still has not been fixed, the situation with psych, because we took all their beds and all their rooms and we made that the COVID unit. So I was in charge up there for probably March until well into the summer, maybe August.
Now, when you say COVID unit, obviously everybody that has is suffering from COVID, but
yeah.
What is that? Could I be like, okay, Joe Trainer, relatively healthy, 55-year-old COVID patient next to somebody that's like dealing with morbidities and a number of morbidities? Is it just like it had to be hard to manage that?
So it kind of went with the wave of COVID. So when COVID happened, we initially, I would say for the first month, people were dying rapidly just because we didn't understand what was happening to them. So about a month in, we figured out that a lot of these patients were dying because their lungs were clotted up with like blood clots. They were basically bleeding out is how they were dying. Another like aha moment was one day I went to work and there's like the refrigerated morgue outside. And initially, the doctors were asking patients to donate their bodies just because they were like, we got to figure out what's going on. And those trucks filled up so quickly because everyone wanted to donate their bodies just to be like, let's figure out what's going on. So initially the unit was like hospice. It was the patients. There weren't enough ventilators.
I remember you saying that.
Yeah. So one of the worst things that happened was we had a young patient. I think he was like 38 years old. I still remember his name. And he had a bone marrow transplant that had failed. And typically our patients that if you have a transplant and it fails, your prognosis is extremely poor.
Sure.
And he cardiac arrested on the floor. And we called a code, which means like cardiac arrest. Sure. You know, anesthesia needs to come. The ICU needs to come.
Yep. All hands on deck.
Yeah. And we get there and the anesthesiologist was like, I can't like give him morphine. Let him go. Like we can't use a ventilator on him. And we all were like, wait, like, I know they're doing this in, like, Nebraska in a hospital with 10 beds, but, like, we're doing this? Like, we have 800 beds. We're the fourth best hospital in the world. And, like, now this is happening to us. So that unit initially was those people that didn't qualify for ventilators or had failed on a ventilator.
Not that I'm apportioning any blame at all because I can't even begin to fathom what those decisions, the magnitude of those decisions, but... Who made the decisions, yay or nay, on is it just degree of severity? Is that like, or degree of savability?
Savability.
Okay.
Savability. So this is a patient with cancer who has failed multiple lines of chemotherapy. So he's failed a transplant. Okay. He's not going to live even if we put him on a ventilator right now.
And that's hard. I can see those decisions needing to be made with a finite amount of ventilators, but man, that had to be just crazy. And then you and other hospital staff having to like not compartmentalize that, but having to process that in your own head, because you know every life that you're charged with is you're trying to save and give the best
opportunity. And he wasn't 100; he was 38. Yeah. Like you'd think on like age alone he would have qualified, but so yeah, the unit ended up being hospice, and then it ended up. So once we kind of figured out how COVID was attacking the body in most people,
could there have been anything? Again, not trying to apportion blame, but like, was this just something that only through trial and error were we going to get to?
100%. Yeah.
So it's not like even, you know, I'm sure to some extent, like all phenomenons, mistakes are made, but like, it wasn't like misinformation as much as it was just trying to gather accurate information. Know. Yeah. Because we didn't know. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, there are some things that like, I remember So there's levels of oxygen, like a nasal cannula, which is like your typical, you see, you know, people walking around with like a prong in their nose, like it goes up to 6 liters. And then there's like three other modes of oxygen that we can give you. Two are machines. Another is just like way more oxygen through your nose. With COVID, I don't know who made this plan up, but basically if you were not, if your oxygen wasn't high enough on the 6 liters, on the first level of oxygen, you were getting intubated. And I always was kind of like, I don't know, like maybe we should let people fight a little bit longer because it's not always easy to come off a ventilator.
Yeah, no doubt.
So personal opinion of things I saw, I think that was probably a mistake from the beginning. But yeah, I mean, there was no way, like we had no idea what was going on. We're like, why are these people coming in with a respiratory illness, having fevers they can't break and then dying because they bleed out? Like it doesn't work the same way as like people want to compare it to the flu. They want to compare it to RSV. Like it's a completely different thing.
So there's really, even though you're, you know, you're charged being an oncology nurse, it's almost as if you spent months as an ER nurse.
It sounds, like we were everything.
Yeah, you were at one-stop shopping, right?
Nurses were like the only people that came to work, too. So absolutely. You're the nurse, you're the aide, you're the PT, you're the manager, you're literally everything. And it did go through that. So it was hospice, and then once we kind of figured out that there were things that we could do, then it became more of like a step-down unit with people who, like, you know, didn't require a ventilator but were still pretty sick. That went on for a while. And then it became like the post-trach unit. So they started getting people off ventilators, but they had to trach them. So I do like medical oncology. I do chemo, medical stuff. Like we don't do surgical. So that was like, I was in charge of the trach unit. I'd probably seen 3 trachs my entire career up until that day. And now I had 36. Oof. And a team of travelers who had very different levels of expertise in nursing.
Man, that had to be crazy.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you this, too. At that time, you know, the empathy that, you know, you got great, you know, I don't want to say bedside manner, but I could see you being someone that, like, is totally immersed in the experience as people, transition to the next life. Was it hard to like be sympathetic? Were you just like doing so much crisis management that like you it was a challenge for you to be present for people, knowing that it was the end for some people? And looking back on that, were you just so consumed with the operational component of your perfunctory duties that, you know, you kind of had to just, hey bud, sorry.
Yeah, like, fight or flight.
Yeah.
For sure. Most of it was just like, you just got to get through. Do the best you can. And like, I think nursing, a lot of people think it's like, you're just taking care of patients. You're just, you know, making sure they're comfortable. Like there's a lot of critical thinking and like science-based, like your brain is working as hard as like your hands are. But it's still a hospital. There's still a lot going on coming from upper management that you're not going to agree with. And I think the hardest part for myself and most of my colleagues, I would say, is that there were no visitors. So these people, we know they're going to die. We made, you know, hopefully in a lot of situations, they've made the decision themselves that they don't want to be on a ventilator. But now it's, you know, they're dying alone or they're dying with me. Like
that's a lot of pressure.
And it's like, you know, these are grandmothers. They've got, you know, 8 kids and 16 grandchildren and a great grandchild. And like their last moment of their life is with me.
Or 38-year-old. Bone marrow recipients, right? That, you know, had the whole thing at them.
Yeah, we had like a ton of younger people, even in their 20s. And like, you're with me. Like, we just felt so badly about that. Like, I will never ever forget a patient. She actually was one of our leukemia patients, but had been doing really well, had done really well in treatment. She was older for sure, like probably late 80s. And it was one of these, came from a tight knit Spanish family. And one of the reasons COVID hit minorities so much was because they live in generational housing.
Sure.
So it's like great grandma lives with, you know, the great grandchild.
Yeah. It's like a petri dish. Yeah.
Yeah. They all get sick. But she was like a very religious Spanish woman who had a ton of kids, ton of grandchildren, whatever. And her family, we had iPads and we would FaceTime them so they could like watch their loved one die. And they were like, can you read this Bible verse for us? Can you like do this? And we were just like, just come, like we'll sneak you in.
Sure.
Like, that's awesome. That was the worst part.
But that's the beauty of you, and you're not getting caught up in at those moments that you can never get back. You're like you're still having the heart you have. Folks, we'll be back with Victoria Hudak after this brief message.
You're listening to In His Sign Catholic Radio, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. We are blessed to have had this Catholic radio apostolate for almost 40 years now. Thanks be to God for your partnership. Without you, this radio voice would be silenced. We have a monthly Mass offered for you, our loyal family of listeners. It's our way of saying thank you for underpinning our apostolate with your many prayers and financial support. This is your radio ministry, to be a voice for those who have no voice, to evangelize and to catechize for a time such as this. We know the Lord will bless you abundantly. He can never be outdone in generosity. If this ministry has touched your heart, help us to touch other hearts by supporting us with your prayers and financial support. Call us at 610-527-2906 or visit our website at inhissign.com.
Welcome back to Souls on Fire. I'm your host, Joe Trainer, here with Victoria Hudak, oncology nurse up at New York Presbyterian. One more question before we move on, and I don't want to belabor the COVID, but now that's, what did we say, mid-March, 19, when did you feel like, okay, we're returning to some level of normalcy, in medicine, in hospital care?
For me, so I didn't see my family for about 3 months.
Mm. Crazy.
Yeah. So when I could have the escape of, the beach again, when my family was like, all right, you can be around us again, that's when I started to feel better. But it felt like I was literally living on two different planets, because I had the planet of my friends and my family who were still being cautious, but still trying to be we can't live like this forever. And then I would go back to work and it was
triage.
I would say things started to feel in the hospital recently, maybe the last 6 months, of people being all right, we got to learn to live with this, and we can't deter care at every angle anymore. It's not going anywhere.
Sure.
And
we know more about it.
We know more about it. People aren't getting as sick as they were, and there were a lot of negative effects about the way it was handled in the first place. Other illnesses and other things got worse because we had no focus on
it.
So I would say in the last 6 months, people are we got to live with it now.
And will there be the next great one down the road, or will it be, was this kind of a reset do you see in the next 5 years, there's another Irish flu or something coming down the pike?
I hope not. I mean, historically there's a plague every 100 years, and we're pretty much on target with the Spanish flu. Good. Historically speaking, but these are also times where it took 40 days to, take a boat somewhere. I mean, we're quite literally traveling diseases, world in an airplane, no problem.
No
so
doubt.
Are things probably going to happen more often than they have historically? Yeah. Do I think we're going to have something I hope we never have it again, really, in your lifetime.
Sure. Nice. Nice. Well, hopefully.
But I mean, that's a hope.
Sure. I gotcha. Let me ask you this too. So, we're talking a little bit about it before the show, but oncology nurses, you're really, it's the vocation within the vocation. We were talking about, friend groups, and we all, you have, these men and women that you love and that you've kind of come up with, and, but you kind of And I think this is one of the reasons that you know, my family loves you so much is because you have a big picture feel to your approach to life. You know, most men and women your age are, you know, suffer from the disease of me, and it's all about me. And I think I'm leaning to calling it a blessing, like the fact that you are around death so mm-hmm. much that you just you'll never you have a perspective that just is such a blessing, because you can appreciate when you see a 38-year-old, you know, male who doesn't, you know, the bone marrow transplant doesn't take, and you know, COVID aside, you see mm-hmm. you see death at every turn, old, young, rich, poor, you know, black, white, you know, the whole mm-hmm. gamut of death and its impact on everybody. Like, it's got to be a blessing in a way, because it your perspective is so different than the rest of us. No,
right? Yeah, I mean, perspective, like, hit that we joke about, like, perspective slaps us in the face every day. Like, you can be having a bad day, or something's not going right in your life, or you're upset about something like small and dumb that's not going to matter, and then you walk into work and you're like, oh wow, like, these are real problems. Like, anything, most other things that go on in your life, like, thankfully, are not life sure. and death problems, and that's what we deal with. I mean, I was a pretty new nurse when COVID happened, but end of life care and, like, end of life, just everything that goes into that, like, was not a new concept to me. So I think it was harder on, like, you know, the OR nurses or people that deliver babies. Like, it was a really, really big problem for them. For us, end of, you know, I would say 50% of what I do is life saving. And the other 50% is, like, dying with dignity mm. and end of life and like helping families through that. So that wasn't so new for me.
That's awesome. I mean, that awesome in the sense that they're lucky to have you, but also that in and of itself is just a tremendous gift.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I don't know if privilege is the right word, but it is a privilege to be able to be with people
sure.
in those moments. And I do think, I mean, as for my friends, it's just, they don't, it's so different what
sure.
they
no,
do
and no
what
fault
I
of
do.
Theirs, yeah.
Absolutely no fault of theirs, but it's hard to explain something like that to
sure.
people. Like, you have to be there and, like,
sure.
know those kind of things. And thankfully, my friends haven't had to do that.
Sure. I read a great book this summer. It was by these two doctors from Cooper's over in Jersey. And it was the CEO and the chief of staff. And they talked about, you know, the book was called The Wonder Drug. And it talked about when we're other-centered, our health is never better than we're mm-hmm. focused on others, you know. And, you know, I look at on a much lower level, you know, young people with social media and, you know, and the focus of, like, my likes, my retweets, my comment, all the things that are pertaining to me. And then, but God's great providence, it's like when we're focused on other people, that's when we get the endorphins of feeling good, making mm-hmm. a difference, you know, perspective.
Yeah.
You know, and but the one question I did have for you was, you know, even not like, you know, yeah, it doesn't have the frenzy that COVID brought about, but you're still dealing with, like, incredibly emotional days. You know, again, this isn't, you know, it's not like, you know, me or, you know, somebody, you know, in a regular job where if an invoice isn't paid, it's not life or death or, mm-hmm. you know,
they act like it is, but
no, but yes, but you're like literally, you know, you're immersed in life and death every day, all day,
yeah.
every week of the year. Is there any, other than your faith, is there any relief? Like, is there, like, we talked about PTSD when mm-hmm. COVID was hitting, but, like, just the trauma and the drama of dealing with, like, people that, you know, oh my God, I just spent the last 2 minutes of that person mm-hmm. with them and they had no one else but me. Like that's got to be an incredibly emotional. How do you cathart that? How are you able to process that so that it doesn't, like, and then the next day, oh, by the way, it could be washer and repeat, and it's
yeah.
the same
and
thing the next
is.
Day. Yeah.
I mean, death in threes, it's a real thing. But
how are you able to kind of just move beyond that so it's not like, it doesn't like overwhelm you.
I think there's two things. I mean, I think everyone can agree that like doing things for other people makes you feel good about yourself. Like there is that like selfish, I don't know if selfish is the right word, but like that selfish feeling of like, I made a difference today. Sure. Like no matter how hard my job gets or how much I might disagree with anything that goes on, like I leave every day and I'm like, I did something good. Like I made a difference. It could have been I gave a blanket to someone.
Sure.
Or I advocated for like a medication that I thought would help, or like those things.
Or let sneaking somebody in during COVID.
Hide in the bathroom. I won't tell anybody.
Yeah, so like, that you could say goodbye to a loved one.
Yeah, like you're old. No matter how bad it gets, I feel like I always do something good. And like that, you just have to focus on those parts of it. Does it get to me? Absolutely. But yeah, I think that's kind of what gets you through. Also, I mean, death, I don't want to say death is normal to me, but we do see it so much. And like you see people die really terribly. And then there's people that you've learned from those situations and you can try to make people like die with dignity or be comfortable or explain to their family like really well, you know, we're focusing on comfort now. We're not going to do anything that's going to hurt them and like let them have a peaceful death. It's not going to traumatize their family or, you know, it might sound weird, but like having someone have a peaceful death is something that like myself and my colleagues would like take pride in. Like
sure.
We're happy when those things happen because you're really usually at the end of life. I mean, these are patients we sometimes know for years.
Sure.
Like we'll have them through like several rounds of chemo and times of remission that are so exciting. And then, you know, relapse with, we deal with like extremely complex cancers. So we know their families and like they grow to love us and
sure.
trust us and like, I just can't imagine not doing that. So, yeah, I mean, I don't – there are bad days, but they're far less than
That's
the
awesome.
Days I feel good about it.
Let me ask you this. How has being so close to death, how has that impacted your faith journey? Like, is it helped? Is it kind of kept you close to, you know, God and the presence of God mm-hmm. just because he's around?
I mean, for me, I feel like my job is my faith.
Amen.
Like, yeah, I don't know how I would be able to do it without like the foundation and like my belief in something higher. And we do see like, I really believe in like numbers. And you can tell like we've had patients who literally their one kid's flying across the country to see them for the last time. And they will stay alive until the second that kid walks through the door. Like, those kind of like I believe in those kind of things, and I think most of my coworkers do. Not that we've all grown up the same or grown up in the same religion or faith or anything, but I mean, I have to believe that those things like matter and they come from something higher than us, you know.
Sure.
And like just knowing like the way I grew up is that you know they're in a better place, and like that might sound dumb to other people,
no.
or you know you just implode into the world somewhere, but like, I do truly believe that. Like, I watch these people suffer a lot of time. And then, like, you know, sometimes I'm, like, I'm happy. I'm, like, they're with God or they're wherever they picture themselves to be.
Sure.
And it does give you peace. And I think that's definitely something that's part of my faith.
Do you feel yourself having, like, crazy candid conversations with people at the end? Like,
yeah.
Like...
So when I was on night shift. So day shift, and I will say typically at the end of life, not all the time, but... People know they're dying.
Sure.
They know they're going to die. They know they can't beat it again. They don't want to do chemo again, whatever the reason is, but they're doing it for their family. So during the day shift, the family's there. They're like, do everything, do this, do that, whatever. and we're just like, you're making me torture me, Ma. Like, this
sure.
is... And then, so when I was working, I worked night shift for 4.5 years. And like, there's nothing truer than like a 3 a.m. conversation when they're just
sure.
like, I don't want to do this. I hate this family member. I like that one. Like, give this check to this person, but don't tell anyone I did that. Like, those kind of things.
Do you have any of those, like, just kind of problems of the world? Like, does anybody talk about, like, regrets they might have had or anything like that? Like, you know, like kind of those intimate, like, moments? Because,
yeah.
again, you might be the only person that's privy to those
yeah.
final days of intimacy.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I remember that I had a patient and I like remember what room he was in. I remember everything. And he was elderly and he was like, what are you doing this weekend? Like a lot of people just like, well, I have two things. Either they think I'm really old and not married yet because they're like, wait, you're 28 and
yeah.
you're not married. Like what? or they're like, you're so young. Like do whatever you want. Sure. And I had this elderly man, and I guess he was like, what are you doing this weekend? You're off. Like, because they know our schedules. They're like, you've been here for 3 days. Sure. So now you have time off. Like, what are you doing? And I was like, all my friends are going to the Poconos, but like, I'm tired. I kind of want to go home. Like, I'll sit the weekend out. And he was like, you got to go. Like, what? Like, just go. Like, when are you going to do this again?
That's
like,
awesome.
Things like that. But yeah, I mean, I love old people. So like, I'll sit and talk to them forever.
You're an old soul. I've always
Yeah. I'll talk like this all day long. My friends are like, no, we don't want to talk about this. Like,
where are we going to happy hour?
They'll just like look at me like, okay, can we stop talking about this now?
That's funny. I know, obviously, you get your master's from Columbia. Mm-hmm. You know, great school, great program. You know, you're like, you know, you certainly have the skill set to transcend, not that you want to, but like certainly up the administrative ladder, in hospital administration, you know, the credentials being what they are, you know, but here you are like a foot soldier that's kind of just, at the front lines. That's really, I'm sure there's some things that about your job day to day that, you know, you don't like to have to kind of be force-fed something from mm-hmm. the top that you may not agree with, but where do you, like, in the next 5 to 10 years, is this your calling for the short term, or would you see yourself eventually move, you know, I don't want to say moving up, because that would be denoting like you're not at a great place right now, but
I have no idea. I do love I don't want to do a job that's not like patient facing. Like, I don't want to do a job that's like directing nurses or directing nurse managers. Like, for the time being, like, I still really enjoy my patient contact.
Sure.
Like, both the like personal side of it and the like just like brain stimulating side of it. But it's hard work. I mean, it's tasking on your body, to be honest with you. Like,
we're lifting
and pulling and pushing, and like, my back hurts sometimes.
Yeah. And when somebody calls out, like, it still has to get done.
Oh, yeah.
It's not like you're saying, you know, what might take normally 2.5 people, if somebody's not there, it still has to get done. You're not going to tell the patient,
right,
like, this can't happen. I can't bring this
machine. Oh, and the hospital
will
be like, don't tell them we're short-staffed. I'm like, I'm supposed to have 3 patients, and I have 6, like, and they're screaming at me that I didn't do something. So I'm telling them, here's my manager's number. Like,
please call.
Yeah. But, yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I'm a natural born leader. I think it just, I was
absolutely
born the first child. I was,
yeah,
you know, in, I mean, I was captain of my lacrosse team my junior year. Like, I'm just born that way, to be honest with you. And I'd be lying if I said there aren't days that I'm walking into work like, I wish I could sit at a desk today.
Sure.
I just don't think I'm there yet. I won't say it's never coming.
Sure.
But I still like the stress and the craziness of,
sure,
like, patient care.
Yeah, and you're making it different. I mean, you're like literally, you're taking a, you know, a skunk sandwich, right? And kind of like making it digestible for a lot of people that, not everyone gets cured.
No.
But I think the difference you're making in death, even more than life, probably more profound.
Right.
You know, 100%. Giving somebody the ability to die with dignity, giving somebody the ability to not die alone, you know, there's, as sad as it is and as crazy as this statement is, there's got to be some comfort in saying, like, that's as important as the person that becomes cancer-free and returns to a life of you know, success or normalcy.
Right.
You know? Like, when you're dealing with people that don't, like, you have a whole gamut of, you know, death happens to all of us, right?
Yeah.
Quote unquote spiritual, whatever we interpret mm-hmm. that to be, and atheist. But like, when you're dealing with somebody, obviously you're going to, on their deathbed, you're going to kind of defer to their comfort zone of where they are in their journey, you know, whether it's Muslim, Buddhism, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. Hindu, whatever it is, Catholic. But like, for the person that may not have a faith based, do you ever find them calling out and asking you to kind of, like, you know, like, for your, like, hey, what do you do? What should I be doing here? Do you ever find those inquisitive people at the end where that may not have come from any faith-based background where you're saying, oh, can you help me out here? I don't have a frame of reference.
Yeah. I mean, I have been asked before, like, you know, like, what's going to happen?
Sure.
And I'm like, you mean like when you die? Like, I have no idea. Like, I can tell you what I think, but
sure,
that is a common question that people ask, and it's faith-based people and not. I mean, we have so many different religions, and you, the way you're brought up in culture and your religion and your faith has so much to do with end of life care.
Sure.
Like, it dictates, I would say 90%, and agnostic too. Like, if you don't believe in anything and they say, hey, medically, there's nothing we can do for you and you can leave, like, that's still dictating how the end of your life is going to go.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I definitely have a bigger connection with people that grew up Christian because, sure, you know, you can say things like, he's going to be in a better place, or he's going to, sure, be with God, or he's going to be with, you know, his wife that died 3 years ago.
Sure.
Or I feel like I can say those kind of things, and it's comforting to patients when medical people can be, like, personable.
More than just a medical authority.
Right. Yeah. And, like, and not to say that there's, I mean, there's doctors, there's everything that does that, but the nurses are there 24/7 at the bedside. So I think it's more comforting when it's like, hey, like, I'm human too. Like, this is, sure, yeah, it's your family member, but, like, it affects us too. And, yeah.
Do you think, is there, again, this is just kind of a, I guess, a, horseback observation. Do you find the MO traditionally has been, well, nurses are the emotional caregivers in death and sickness,
mm-hmm,
and the doctors are kind of just the idea people. Is that an accurate stereotype?
No.
Is that?
I don't think so.
No.
I mean, I said to my brother one time, I was telling him a story, and I guess I sounded like kind of mean. I don't know what it is. I mean, there's times that I disagree with the medical plan, or I disagree with medication, or I don't think a dose is high enough because of whatever I think.
And you're able to verbalize that, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not the nurse who's going to sit there and be like, oh, it's the order.
Sure.
Like, I will call them and be like, this is wrong. Like,
good for you.
For this reason, you know,
I want
change
you to
it
be
or
my
whatever.
Nurse at the end, okay?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Somehow you have to get me,
yeah,
a New York Presbyterian.
But my brother was like, well, that's not, like, he's like, aren't nurses nice? And I'm like, I don't want to say this in a bad way, but, like,
no, you're
being
the advocate.
A good nurse,
yeah,
has nothing to do with being nice.
Sure.
Like, you want someone who's going to advocate for you. And obviously, like, yes, nurses are very nice and they can make you feel comforting. But I think the most comfort you're going to feel is when you have a nurse who you trust medically, emotionally, physically, like, in all ways. So to diminish, like, just to being like, oh, we, you know, rub your back and make you feel good, I don't think that's true. And vice versa with doctors. Like, I've had plenty of doctors come up to me and be like, hey, they look super uncomfortable. Like, what do you think? Like, let's change this. I'll order whatever you want. What's going to be the best? Like,
awesome. So it's
doctors have it too. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome. Do you see much burnout with some of your older counterparts? Like, just emotionally, like, you get to a point where, like, this is, like, and then the dog years of COVID, right? It was only,
right,
it was 2.5 years, but it was probably, like, 10 years in terms of the shelf life.
I can't even imagine, honestly.
Yeah.
I find it less with the older nurses. So my unit has, we call them the OGs. They're, like, 40 plus years as nurses.
Wow.
And I think they're just, like, it just is what it is to them now. Like, they don't get upset about the things that we get upset about. Like, we'll be upset about management doing something, and they're like, we've been through this 45 times. Like, I don't even care anymore. I find it to be more the young nurses who things are still shocking to them, especially nurses who became nurses in the past, like, 2 years, I would say, because their schooling wasn't what the rest of us had.
Sure.
And it's a bad time right now. Like, yes, things are getting better, but, like, the patient load, the emotion, the stress of what's going on in the medical field right now, it's a lot for, like, they're literally 22.
Sure. Let me ask you this. That brings up a good point, though. Like all these, right? Engineers and medical, mm-hmm, professionals, like, you know, more with the, you know, the big ticket professions. But, you know, did you see people coming out of nursing programs, established, credible programs, that are just because of the way they were schooled the last 2 years, are they, like, that much further behind than somebody that might have graduated 4 years,
right,
prior to COVID?
I haven't really noticed it, to be honest. I mean, there's a couple, like, schools in New York that are, like, very well-known schools that I would never recommend for nurses, and I can't say that that's changed since the pandemic. I kind of always am like, they're not really teaching them. I mean, I was super, super lucky. I went to school in North Philadelphia where we were immersed in everything.
Sure.
Like, clean needle clinics, ICUs, like, home care, charter schools, like, and they threw us in. You're expected to do your, like, 16 hours a week. So we had so much patient front, but I don't think a lot of schools do. And I think it's Temple has its own medical school, first of all, and it's in an area where they can literally use any help they can get. Like, we would show up to the floor and the nurses would be like, here's your patient.
Yeah, you would be like, treated like a fourth-year professional.
You're literally there to help.
Yeah.
Not to, like, watch.
Yeah, right.
So that's a huge difference. I don't know. I mean, people say a lot about the work ethic of, like, these new kids. I don't... Yes and no, but I can't say, like, an overgeneralized, like, yes, it's worse. Like, I don't think so.
I just look at, you know, I look at my sons and how they've been schooled in their college career the last couple of years. You know, just starting to return to some type of normalcy, you know, with, like, in-person classes and what's the word I'm looking for? Not virtual, but where you're kind of self-taught or whatever the hell it is. I'm trying to think of the word. Well, it's where you kind of, like, come to class if you have questions. If not, you don't have to sign it. Yeah. I can't believe it's escaped me. But,
like,
yeah.
Teach yourself. Let me know if you have a question.
Yeah, it's basically like self-taught. So, like, even now, like, I know my one son, Dylan, it's like, you know, he's in classes where it's like, okay, you know, it's hybrid one day, in person the next, and kind of self-taught the next on a 3 days. Yeah, so it's like
these teachers are walking out.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, and then I think, you know, it's not faulting any educational program that's being done on the computer, but much different than an in-person experience, right?
Nursing is so hands-on,
right?
It's so hands-on, and it's so much about organization. Sure. And, like, the tests are hard. If you're not organized to the point of, I mean, in college I had, like, you know, most of my these chapters today, and then I gotta do this, I gotta do that. Like, you have to be so organized, and I think part of why nursing programs are so difficult and so rigorous and very strict is because the job is.
Yeah.
So if that's not happening and you get there and you're like, I'll give this med whenever I want. No, I'll look
it's
at that
literally
later.
Life
I'm like,
and
this
death.
Is,
it's
not going to work.
Yeah. If you screw up an invoice at the office, like, and you underbill or overbill, it's not going to, people aren't losing their lives. You know, if you do it, you know, if you misevaluate or misdiagnose or you mismedicate, you know, those are big ticket problems that people are.
I don't know. I can't see how you would self-teach that.
Yeah.
But.
And I also think nursing, maybe more than any profession, like, there's the academic component, right, where you feel, like, well-schooled. And then it's like, to your point, like, you know, hey, here's your patient, you know, and then you're kind of like, oh my, you know, I'm thrown into this. Or, hey, I got to move this massive diagnostic machine into a room, and I usually have two orderlies that assist me here, but they called out, and I got to get this done. So, like, there's the you know, the theory of this academic component, and then there's the reality of the data. You're all things to all people as
exactly.
a nurse. I mean, you have to be sometimes doctor, sometimes nurse, sometimes mom, sometimes confidant, sometimes preacher, sometimes pastor, sometimes you know, union rep, you know, labor, you know, like custodian, you know, all of it, right? It's all like you have to, because the job, you know, you can't, when you're dealing with life and death to the extent that you are, you can't hit the pause button and say, listen, we'll come back to this in a day or so.
Yeah, and I have noticed, I mean, nursing schools in general are, like, insanely hard to get into now. Yeah. Like, it was hard when I went, but I think it's, like, it's ridiculous. A lot of schools are now in, like, single-digit acceptance rates.
Mm.
So that's great, and, like, great for the profession.
Sure.
But at the same time, like, A++ in high school and no life experience and just, you know, super book smart, those nurses they're not always the best.
Yeah. Well, there's such a humanity to the job, right? It's like, it's like that's your emotional IQ and all those things that are going to, like, people at the end, especially people want somebody that's going to have empathy and listen and be present with them authentically than charting some type of medicine. And that's important. I'm not minimizing that, but it's crazy. This was awesome, Victoria. I love you, buddy.
Yeah.
Great hour. And what's your prediction? We're 2.5-point favorite. What do we got next week?
I mean, two weeks. I'm way too superstitious to say, but
come on,
go Birds.
Go Birds. I love it. Folks, talk next week. God bless. Have a great week. Congratulations, Mark Houck, again on the not guilty verdict. Love you, buddy.